wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener supported community radio, and it is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this November 18th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO members, member listeners, and support from the Hot Sardines, bringing their jazz to the Newmark Theater on Sunday, November 24th. Tickets are available at portland5.com. This morning on the Old Mole, we're going to start with a very topical and important issue regarding Bolivia and some of the shenanigans going on there this past week. Dan Jaffe interviews Dr. Gisela Rodriguez. She's a Bolivian sociologist living in Portland, and they'll talk about the roots of the conflict in Bolivia, the record of Morales and his MAS party, and what his ouster means for the future of the Latin American left. Bill Resnick will discuss the impeachment spectacle with Ron Jacobs, a writer for Counterpunch. Jan Hawken talks to Ananis Tupker of 350 PDX about the demonstration coming up at the Capitol in Salem on November 21st to push Governor Brown to take action on the climate emergency. Ananis Tupker is on the board of directors for 350 PDX, who has been working in Portland on climate justice issues for the last 6 years. In addition to being on the board, Ananis is part of 350 PDX's Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion work group. We'll end this morning's show with a little tribute to Joe Hill. His 104-year anniversary of his death is tomorrow, November 19th, and we'll just have a little fun with Phil Oakes' tribute recorded live in Montreal in 1966. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, KBOO/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Dan.
Hi, this is Dan Jaffe for KBOO. On November 10th, Evo Morales, the first indigenous president of the majority indigenous nation of Bolivia, was deposed after a highly contested election on October 20th, and he fled the country to receive political asylum in Mexico. Morales and his Movement to Socialism Party, or MAS, were elected in 2005 and held power for 14 years. Morales was a key element of the Pink Tide, the wave of left-leaning and center-left governments that swept to power in much of South America and part of Central America in the 2000s. After decades of dictatorship, debt, and imposed austerity, and these governments attempted to forge a new economic model that was more independent of the U.S., the IMF, and the World Bank. So what are the factors that led to Morales' removal? Was this indeed a coup? And what should progressives and those on the left understand about the situation in Bolivia that led up to the present conflict? Joining me today to help unpack these and other questions is Dr. Gisela Rodriguez, a Bolivian sociologist who's living here in Portland, and I think listeners may be surprised by some of what she has to say. Welcome, Gisela.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you very much for this space and for the opportunity to offer a more nuanced perspective about what is happening in Bolivia. So, yes, I am from Bolivia. I am also very proud of my indigenous roots. My grandmothers were mujeres de pollera, meaning they were indigenous women. And both of my parents speak Quechua, one of the indigenous languages from Bolivia. I am also a socialist, and I deeply believe in the principles that it is the people, the ones that should decide the collective destiny of their society. And for my doctoral dissertation, I work with indigenous communities in the Bolivian Altiplano in 2018.
Well, let's start right out with the issue I sort of framed at the outset. Bolivia and Evo Morales since 2005 have been viewed by many progressives and those on the left as an icon, as a beacon of hope, by critics of neoliberalism and supporters of economic self-determination around the world. What do people need to understand about the very complex and volatile situation in Bolivia that led up to the current departure of Morales and the somewhat violent conflicts that have followed his removal?
Yeah, I think we need to understand Morales in these last 15 years, the pros and cons of his government. We also need to better understand who the opposition to Morales is, because there is sort of like a simplification that everyone who's opposed to Morales is either a racist or like part of the right wing, which is not true. So if you allow me down, I want to give you some of the context of like a Morales. So 15 years ago, in 2000 and 2003, Bolivia experienced major mobilizations against neoliberal policies such as the privatization of water. These protests were very similar to the ones that Chile is leading today, you know. And by the way, I stand in full solidarity with the people from Chile. And in 2005, it was these radical movements that made possible the election of our first indigenous president, Evo Morales. And then this was an incredible moment of hope for people like me and the majority of Bolivians who supported Morales and his anti-capitalist and anti-colonial project. And to give you a comparison, you know, Morales was to Bolivians what Obama was for Americans in the U.S., a president from a minority or an excluded majority in the case of Bolivia, for a nation that is so embedded in racist structure that in itself is progress. And I think it's also very important to recognize that there were very good things about Morales and his party, the MAS. A brief summary of what maybe many people already know, like the reduction of poverty. There were redistribute programs that benefit mostly poor and working class Bolivians, indigenous people, and an impressive economic growth by an average of 4% since 2005. Now, this economic growth was based on the extraction of natural resources such as natural gas and minerals, but Morales was able to capture these rents and transform them into these progressive programs.
And I think it's worth dwelling a little bit on those major reductions in poverty and income inequality. Some of the statistics are quite dramatic. The reduction in poverty from something like 60% to 35%, hunger reduced from the high 30% to 15%. The Gini index went from something like 0.6 to better than the U.S., 0.43. Investments in infrastructure. So significant improvements using those resources captured from natural resource extraction, yeah.
Yes, and even in my interviews with indigenous people in the Bolivian Altiplano, they told me, you know, President Morales was the only one who did something for the poor people, from receiving nothing to receive something. You know, that for people was a change, and it was indeed what you said. At the same time, however, we started to see a change in Morales and his government from a so-called revolutionary process to a project to maintain state power. And there were ongoing cases of extreme corruption, nepotism, and, you know, also that economic progress that Bolivia experienced was a result of the extractivist model of development. In other words, the economy was never diversified, but it continued to focus on the extraction of natural resources, which has serious and negative socio-environmental effects, especially for indigenous people. And here I want to focus on two major events. For many people like me who supported Morales, the turning point was the Tifnis conflict in 2011. As you know, Dan, Tifnis is a protective natural area that is also home for many indigenous communities in the Bolivian lowlands. And the Morales government had a plan to build a highway throughout these lands without prior and informed consent, which is a violation of indigenous rights. So these indigenous communities protested, and what was the response of Morales? Repression and violence. The second event is in 2016, when Morales called for a referendum to ask Bolivians if we should change the constitution to allow him to run for a fourth presidential election. Now, remember that the Bolivian constitution allows only two consecutive terms for the presidency. So Morales lost the referendum, yet he decided to run for the presidency and anyway. Therefore, his candidacy for this last presidential election was unconstitutional. And for many of us, this is the epicenter of the conflicts and why we are in the chaos we are today.
Yeah. So let's then move to talk about the opposition to Morales. A lot of people have seen on in media coverage, on TV, right-wing groups, military, some of the right-wing groups from the eastern part of Bolivia, and that is certainly a part of the picture. But talk about the different facets of opposition to Morales from both the right and from the left and from popular or progressive forces as well.
Yeah, so here I don't want to talk about the so-called, in quotation marks, leaders, such as like Camacho, because Luis Fernando Camacho is a no one. You know, he's a racist capitalist from the far right of the lowlands who took advantage of this popular protest to become sort of like a hero. And I think this was a big mistake of the protest against Morales. But instead, you know, I want to focus on the people on the ground. Now, it is true that part of the opposition to Morales are racist and fascist groups such as the Unión Juvenil Cruceñista or the Youth Union from the city of Santa Cruz that never supported Morales because they couldn't tolerate being ruled by an indigenous person. I mean, that's how they are. However, they did not lead the massive protests against Morales. We don't want anything to do with them either. And as Jeffrey Bever mentioned, he's a scholar who has done extensive work in Bolivia, there was also significant participation of people from the urban cities, many of them middle class, who are not racist, but who were very easily manipulated by right-wing ideologies. For example, chanting, "This is not Venezuela," or "Evo dictator," which is ridiculous because Morales was not a dictator. But yeah, they were part of the mobilizations. But the people on the ground opposed to Morales were mostly from the urban cities and the rural cities as well, who are also working class indigenous people. You know, like, come on, this is Bolivia. Most people are indigenous. Even if you live in the urban cities, doesn't mean that you are not indigenous or you are middle class. And here it's also important to mention that many groups that once supported Morales joined and led the protests against him, such as ADEPCOCA. They are the Departmental Association of Coca Farmers and Producers from the city of La Paz. And remember that coca, that Evo Morales was a coca farmer, and these people were part of his political base, but then a few years ago they departed from him.
And also, as I understand, a lot of indigenous groups, especially from the eastern part of the country, and environmentalists, feminist groups have sort of become part of the opposition to Morales. Talk about what changed during the middle of his three terms and how the position of his party toward some of the mass popular organizations, labor groups, indigenous groups, shifted, and why you feel like there's so much anger and resentment toward Morales on part of these mass social movements.
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, I think for many of us, the turning point was the Tiffany's conflict. That, you know, this was a protest by indigenous people demanding their rights for informed consent, which Morales said, like, no, we're not going to, you know, ask you whether you want this highway to build through your lands. And their response of Morales was also, like, repression and violence. That was, the turning point for many, like, people who supported Morales. And the other major event was the 2016 referendum. You know, like Morales, he called for the referendum. He asked Bolivians if we should change the constitution. And here we need to remember that the new constitution of Bolivia is considered among the most progressive documents of this type. And yet Morales lost the referendum, but then he decided, like, oh, not to respect the vote and to continue his candidacy for the presidency. So I think those two major issues were what really frustrated people who support Morales ones.
And talk a little more about this sort of decision to push on for a fourth presidential term. In retrospect, it seems like this was probably a very big strategic mistake for Mas, mm-hmm. Or at least it really blew up in their face. Why did Mas not go the route, do you think, of developing new leaders, new indigenous leaders, for example, who could have run in Morales' place for the elections in this year in 2019?
Yeah, so I think the problem with the MAS party, you know, the party of Morales, as well as many, unfortunately, many people on the left, is like we have this idea of caudillismo, that we need this strong leader, this one person. Like, if it is not Morales, no one else could do this. And I think that was a mistake because, like, one of the projects of revolutionary party, such as, you know, like MAS, should have been the development of cadre, of the development of leaders, indigenous leaders, non-indigenous leaders, but they didn't. They were too focused that it was Morales, the only one who could lead this so-called revolution. And I think they were so fixed on that ideology that they said, like, no, Morales is... And they were still believing, and I think underestimate how much, you know, popularity they lost.
Yes. At the same time, Morales did get something like 46 or 47% of the votes in this presidential election in October 20th, so more than any other candidate. So who is Morales' base, the people who still voted for him?
Yeah, no, that's a very important point to remember, Dan, and thank you, because, yeah, it's true. Like, at least 30, if not 40% of the population is still super morales. And these are like mostly coca farmers from the Chapare region, where that's a strong part of his political base, also miners. Also indigenous people, both in the cities and in the rural areas, are part of his, of this political base. And I know there is also some discussion about, and we need to remember that these groups, whether they're pro Morales or against Morales, are also very heterogeneous, because also part of Morales is what Weber calls like indigenous petit bourgeois, you know.
Petit bourgeois,
the people, like indigenous people who under Morales became, you know, like their socioeconomic status improved, which is nothing wrong with that, but the ideology of capitalism is still there. You know, they might be indigenous, but they're still with the capitalist ideas.
Well, and I want to move from there to talk about Morales's relationship with capital, with domestic capital, national business, but also with transnational capital. Your research is on neo-extractivism in Bolivia and the mining and drilling for oil and gas, etc. And many people sort of aware that Morales, you know, either renationalized or shifted the balance of negotiation of extraction of revenue from the mineral extraction to more favor the state, and that gave him the resources to then distribute in these substantial social programs that reduced inequality. But there was also, as I understand, a strongly increasing focus on fossil fuel extraction, on fracking. They began to do fracking, a lot of mining, transnational mining companies. Talk about the role of petrochemical and oil and gas extraction and mining. They have lithium reserves, and what Morales' relationship was with the transnational companies that were interested in developing these resources.
Yeah, well, pretty much it was a very convenient and friendly relationship. And, you know, as Pablo Solon, who was the former UN ambassador for Evo Morales until 2011, mentioned, it is true that the state, you know, the government has to negotiate with capitalism. We cannot, the state cannot just turn away, because if that's what will happen, is what will happen in Chile with Allende, right? So it needs capital. But there are also principles and repression against indigenous people, the very people that Morales promised to protect, like that can, which we cannot tolerate that, right? I mean, that was the big contradiction, that Morales was having this friendly, cozy relationships with the extractivist sector. And for a while, I mean, we have some political stability in Bolivia precisely because he had a good relationship with capital, you know? It's not like what he was saying, like, oh, capitalist is either capitalism of Mother Earth. Actually, for Evo Morales, was more of a support for the capitalist class in Bolivia, especially in the lowlands, which is kind of ironic because they are the ones that now, you know, demanded also his resignation.
What, looking forward, talk about the situation in the current moment, and what do you expect is likely to happen next? It's clear that Morales had lost support from a substantial part of the population, but still had the backing of almost half of the country. His party, the MAS party, has 2/3 of the Congress. We're also seeing the rise of ultra-white right-wing forces that some analysts are saying have basically taken advantage of this space created by a more genuine popular opposition. There is a well-known commentator, Uruguayan Raul Cibecci, who you sent me an article. He wrote, "We can't forget that in this moment there is the serious danger that the racist, colonial, and patriarchal right wing will succeed in taking advantage of the situation to seize power and provoke a bloodbath." What do you see as the most likely path forward? Are we going to be seeing new elections, power sharing? Is there a risk of another full-scale military coup, a return to military dictatorship, so that Bolivia's experienced in the past? What do you see as likely to happen going forward?
Yeah, so the risk of a military coup is always, now especially, is always present. And unfortunately, the interim president, Jeanette Áñez, who took the presidency in an emergency situation, is very conservative. You know, the first thing she did was to come to the palace with a Bible in her hands. And she had made some very racist, she had some very racist tweets about Morales, and she's already questioning the participation of the MAS party in the upcoming elections. And I think, you know, that's not a call for peace and negotiation, but that's going to lead to more confrontations if we don't let the party of Morales, the MAS, to participate. At the same time, you know, as Silvia Rivera Cusicanqui, who's a famous sociologist and activist from Bolivia, stated, Evo Morales is gone, but our hope to build a plurinational Bolivia, our hope to build a Bolivia that is represented by our indigenous root, is not. So, you know, like, we need to remember that what happened in Bolivia was was because social movements did it, not Evo Morales. So Evo Morales is the product of social movements, not the other way around. This struggle continues. And we have to remember, like, you know, like in Bolivia, everything is possible because Bolivian people have demonstrated throughout history that we can, you know, overcome. Like people already saying like, oh, this is Bolivia is going to be like Brazil, you know, with another Bolsonaro, because Camacho is like Bolsonaro. But maybe, but it's not yet. So we cannot already give up and grant, you know, the far right, you know, a win, a takeover, because they haven't. This means that we still need to struggle and support the people in solidarity and not the state.
Well, what would that look like? What would progressives and those on the left who are concerned about the same kinds of outcomes, this flourishing of genuine democracy, a plurinational Bolivia, the ability to maintain an independent model of economic and social development and ecological development in Latin America, what perspectives can people here in the North take, or what actions can they take to sort of support that outcome, which seems to sort of be getting lost between the other the various forces that are sort of jockeying for power right now?
Well, we need to be critical of whoever is in the state, whether it is Morales or whether it is this far right wing, you know, people that have sort of like take advantage of this momentum, yeah. You know, like I think that's important because people are very easy, like there is this kind of victimization of Evo Morales, of what happened, but we need to be critical of that.
Very briefly, we have a moment in Latin America with enormous change and upheaval. Sort of center-left government was just reelected in Argentina next door. President Lula da Silva, former President Lula da Silva in Brazil, after his being jailed for over a year and a half, was just freed from jail. Mass protests in Chile. What do you see the situation in Bolivia signifying for the prospects for popular, progressive, indigenous movements, for the Pink Tide, the left project, both in Bolivia and in Latin America?
Well, again, we need to remember that it's not these leaders. It's not Hugo Chavez, it's not Lula, it's not Evo Morales. It's the people who created these movements. Therefore, our hope to build this, you know, plurinational country based on indigenous, you know, identity is not over. The struggle continues.
And where can people turn to find out more good information, analysis, news on what's happening in Bolivia? Can you suggest a few websites, authors, or news sources?
Yeah, well, I have, in Spanish, you can always check Mujeres Creando, an anarcho-feminist group that is very well recognized in Bolivia, Página 7, a news outlet. Also, like the analysis by Jeffrey Weber is very...
Weber. W-E-B-B-E-R.
Very important because he's very critical. He offers you that nuance, and I can send you a couple of those links.
And we will post links to those and other sources on our Old Mole Variety, our webpage, the page for this particular segment. So I have been speaking with Dr. Gisela Rodriguez, a Bolivian sociologist living here in Portland, and we've been talking about the aftermath of Evo Morales' leaving power, being removed from power, and the prospects for progressive and left forces in Bolivia in the aftermath. Thank you so much, Gisela Rodriguez.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks again.
La onda, hip hop boliviano. Esta es tu mafia candela, tu mafia andina, divina, ardiente como el fuego que circula entre tus venas.
That is Santa Malo. It's an all-female Bolivian hip-hop group, a great find. I suggest looking them up. This is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We have Bill Resnick coming up next. He is going to be talking about the impeachment spectacle. And I don't think there's a better word for it. Spectacle. He's talking with Ron Jacobs, who writes for Counterpunch.
Ron Jacobs, welcome to KABU.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Ron Jacobs is a writer based in Burlington, Vermont. He studies and writes on U.S. politics. His book, Daydream Sunset, 60s counterculture in the 70s. His latest, longest work is a pamphlet, Capitalism is the Problem. He's been watching the impeachment hearings and the build-up to them and the public response. In an article he published on the website Counterpunch, with a quite large left audience, he sums up with the observation, "The hearings reveal the nature of establishment thought. They also reveal the intentional nature of the political chaos created by the Trumpists, a chaos designed to allow the nation's most reactionary elements in politics and business to install their reactionary rule." Ron Jacobs, tell us how you came to those conclusions. Discuss the impeachment.
It goes actually from well before the impeachment, just watching the Trump campaign and since the inauguration. Basically, seems that the Republicans, who are all to the right of Donald Trump during the 2016 campaign, they realized that Trump could get their party back into power. Well, since the beginning of the 20th century, the Republican Party has represented some of the most reactionary business interests in the United States. And then once the Dixiecrats left the party, and with Nixon's Southern strategy, it took that over. So I think the Republicans realized that if they could get back in the White House, they could continue the trend towards a United States of America that's good for, to put it bluntly, rich white people. What the Trumpians have done is they've created a lot of chaos just in the way he runs the government, and especially the firing and hiring people at will, it seems, chasing people away, bad-mouthing people on Twitter, so on and so forth. It seems that it creates this chaos that some people who long for stability will go towards the party promising them the stability, which can be the Republicans since they're in power. And then at the same time, it creates such a diversion that a lot of things can get through that people aren't paying attention to. I mean, one could argue that's the intention of a fair amount of what he does, whether it's intentional or not. It's definitely the objective outcome of a lot of the sideshows that have gone on during the Trump administration.
Most of the stuff he's enacted is traditional right-wing objectives, which is enrich the rich and frighten everybody else and destroy labor unions and open up every conceivable way of making profits, regardless of the environment or the social impacts. That's a Republican wish list that he has basically followed, it seems to me, very successfully, actually, especially in the tax cut. Quite remarkable.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that he has also, given the nature of his violent nature of a certain number of his followers, his racism and so on, his overt racism, bringing it right into the White House and making no beans about it for the most part. Socially, that's even more reactionary than some of the traditional Republicans who try to maintain at least a different veneer to their politics, say the Bush family or even Mitt Romney and so on, who will at least go along with the idea that America is a land that's open to all races and people of different nations and so on, whereas Trump makes no bones. He picks out people that he goes after, immigrants, yeah. African-Americans, so on and so forth, gay people, trans people, etc.
So Ron Jacobs, a writer, is going to be on Counterpunch website. Ron's been talking about how the Republican Party wants to stay in power and is supporting Trump. Let's talk about the Democrats and the impeachment hearings, which have really in many ways turned into, at least for those first few days, they've turned into a celebration of the U.S. empire and seeing it as sort of democratic. Tell us about how that's occurred. The Democrats, it seems to me, are worse than the Republicans in that respect.
I agree with you 100%. I look at it as there's two parties, but there's really only one party, and both parties wants to advance what they call U.S. interests overseas, which means expanding the empire, whether it's creating new markets, whether it's opening up new places for resources, whatever it happens to be, whatever combination of that. The Democrats have been operating off of the neoliberal model that actually began under Carter, but kicked up a notch under Reagan, who talked isolationism, but at the same time continue to expand the markets and expand the U.S. empire. I agree with you that it's been a cheerleading section for U.S. empire, and I think that's partially intentional because I think they are trying to portray themselves as the more American party. I don't know how successful that will be, but if one looks at it, U.S. wars are supported by both parties, and that's always been the same. For a lot of people growing up who were born after the 70s or whatever, their understanding of the Democrats is that they were more or less an anti-war party, only because the wars they waged were on a smaller scale. For like example, Clinton and Obama, they shot cruise missiles or used drones as opposed to massive invasions like both of the Bush presidents. At the same time, if you go back in history, the Democrats, they started the Vietnam War. They carried it on for a very long time, and Nixon continued it into his time.
And then there's Latin America.
If you'll notice, the most recent coup down there, only a couple Democratic elected representatives have come out against it on any level. Bernie Sanders, for one, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who was much stronger than Bernie was.
If you read Ron's piece, he points out all of the testimony has been that the Democrats have sought is sort of portrays the Russians as the great evil in the world, and the Ukrainians as democratic freedom fighters that Trump has managed to replace with fascists. Both parties are vying for the most patriotic and therefore celebrating these great American virtues of freedom and democracy. It just sort of comes out in so many ways. Those diplomats just clothe themselves in those ideas. You can read Ron Jacobs a lot more on that. Ron, I think we'll be talking again. It seems to me that the Democrats could move on the path of not just obstruction of justice, but inciting to violence. It seems to me that's a criminal act. There are so many times that he has called for violence from his supporters and supported violence. But I don't think they're going to touch that, I'm afraid. You know, and also his rejection of any limitations on presidential power. But we will find out, and we'll keep talking to Ron Jacobs. Ron Jacobs, thanks so much for talking to us.
Yes, thanks for having me on.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. It's listener-supported community radio. I'm Denise Morris, your host. I am here with Patricia Kohlberg, our engineer. Next on The Old Mole, we have Jan Hawken talking with Anais Tupker of 350 PDX. Jan?
Anais Tupker, welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Well, this is an important week, and you're here to talk with us about the rally scheduled for this Thursday at the Capitol in Salem to push Governor Brown to stop the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and frack gas pipeline in southern Oregon,
mm-hmm.
A project that the state will be making its final decision on in terms of their permits in late January. First, Anais, tell us what the Jordan Cove project is and the extent of it, and then why it's so worrisome that this even could have gone this far.
Yeah. So the Jordan Cove project is really, it's easy to think about it as two pieces. There's the actual export facility, which would be built in Coos Bay, and that's the name of it is Jordan Cove, and that would be exporting fossil fuels to Asia for use in Asian markets. The other piece of it is a pipeline across southern Oregon. And that pipeline goes across the lands of private landowners. It goes across federal lands. It crosses hundreds of waterways. It goes across lands that tribal communities have rights to. So when we're talking about this facility, there's both a piece of thinking about the impact that exporting these fossil fuels to the world will have on our climate. There's also a piece that's very important about the dangers to us here in Oregon because of impacts on land and water and on people's rights, people's property rights, community property rights. And what's interesting is that We have very few mechanisms to actually fight this project legally based on the impact it's going to have on the climate, right?
That's why there's so much focus on the immediate impact on health, the potential for leaks.
Yeah, I mean, the immediate impacts are very, the risks are very real. So they're serious, too.
Because these pipes do inevitably leak. And
they do
have their own emissions, even if they're running properly.
Even if they're running properly, right.
Are invasive in many ways. But even if these pipes could be secured in a way that prevented any leaks, it mm-hmm. would still be a bad idea because it's a bad product that's
exactly.
staggering in its impact.
Exactly, because we're at the point where we absolutely cannot be persisting with the burning of fossil fuels, with the extraction of fossil fuels. And so, you know, anything that expands those markets rather than looking to how we can find other energy sources, how we can reduce the production of petrochemical products, because that's actually another piece of this, is how the products would probably be used for making plastics. It's the wrong direction. It's the wrong direction for us to be spending even a penny of government money, of our money. And
in fact, we should be investing in undoing these things right. that are already there. But I think that itself suggests how, what a big octopus, it's more than a snake, mm-hmm. an octopus that mm-hmm. has tentacles all over the place and interlocking pipelines and terminals, and yeah. it can be staggering in the scope of it and where all this stuff comes
well,
from.
Well, yeah, that's both a very nice way for you to get me out of my blunder, but it's true that often, I mean, that is how we have to approach this, as a network of pipelines and projects that are all seeking outlets.
Yeah.
And so it is entirely possible that, you know, a project that is intended, a line that is intended for one use, could be used for other things. So our solidarity in fighting these projects has to be very strong as well, because there's really, there, you know, we talk about the thin green line of this region, and it's really true that we have to work together in California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia to stop all of these export facilities.
And that thin green line refers to all along the Pacific coast, the
yeah,
resistance.
Yeah, it's the term that's come up in recent
yeah,
years for what we're doing.
Barbara Bernstein has a radio mm-hmm. documentary on that. So why has Governor Brown, who presents herself as a champion of responding to climate change, why has she been so resistive? I mean, she's on a big committee on land use, right?
That's and right. She's on the land use board.
And she's the governor. And there are she has a lot of support in the scientific reviews, environmental reviews of this project so far, which have raised enormous red flags about its impacts.
Over 200 pages of critiques, and you know, from state agencies identifying problems. And one thing we didn't mention is that the federal government, so there's an interplay between federal and state approvals, and the federal government released its report last Friday recommending that the project be approved. This is not at all surprising, because the FERC, as it's called, often
the Federal Energy Regulatory
Commission. Yes, that often it's kind of a rubber stamp agency, and especially under the current administration. So even though there were all of these critiques and a number of crucial areas of mitigation were not spelled out at all in that environmental review, you know, basically the review saying there are problems here, but it's going to be possible to mitigate them, so let's not take them too seriously, without actually giving the details. That's the kind of review that they issued and recommended for approval. So that's the federal piece. But there are state permissions that need to be given. And as you mentioned, Governor Brown is on the land use board. So she has the authority to step in and stop this.
You know, and apparently this would be the largest single contributor to carbon emissions or
if
climate
were.
Warming in the state, and pretty much negate anything else that's being done. I mean, it's staggering in the impact of this project.
Yes.
That would. Any sane person.
Right. So if you're looking and thinking about what's going to be our long-term impact, then you have to think that this project is out of line with everything else that we might be trying to do. And just as you say, it would cancel out any other impacts. But, you know, to your question, why Governor Brown hasn't done this, we don't know. We are truly, I think, in the community, truly mystified why she hasn't stepped up and used her authority. She says she's a climate champion. That's why we're having this rally.
Why wear red? Although that, well, you explain it. Why we're wearing red?
Red has just become the color. Much as, I mean, it's sort of interesting that we have a thin green line, but we wear red, so we wear red.
And the indigenous.
There's also because of indigenous, red being associated with indigenous communities
and indigenous resistance gatherings. And I think it's interesting too that there is resistance all along the thin green line up to British Columbia, and actually the gas that's expected to come in to Jordan Cove is from tribal lands in Fort mm-hmm. John, BC.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's resistance by First Nations groups throughout Canada to the extraction and transport of this product. So along this web of this vast and lethal infrastructure is also a parallel web of resistance.
Yes.
That we're part of here and beyond.
Yes,
what about the local resistance to this project in Coos Bay and that area?
There's tremendous local resistance, and there has been for a long time. And that's the thing to remember as well. This project there's been such resistance and such evidence about the negative impacts of this project. It has been killed twice before. This is the third go-round.
At the permit
Yes,
process.
At the permitting level. And actually, even once before, the FERC even denied a permit, which kind of just, you know, recommended against approving it.
And the
which
company
really
just
shows
took another go at it.
With the changes at the federal level, the company was encouraged absolutely by this administration to go ahead and give it another go. And so that's what we're dealing with now. But I just want to point out that, like, when we talk about local resistance, it has been going on for over a decade with people on the ground really standing strong, both some of the tribal communities really advocating for an understanding of how this will impact waterways, which are crucial to their cultural life and to the health of everyone in the region, because if there's a spill, it can impact everyone. But even if there's not a spill, because of the changes that are done, you're killing trees, you have to clear areas, that changes the temperature of the water. There's very, like, complex but easily documented mechanisms that come into play.
In terms the effects on the whole ecosystem.
Right, right. And so, and a lot of that's available on the internet, actually, if I could think of it. There's beautiful work that I think Rogue Climate and some of the other groups working in Southern Oregon have put together. You can go look this up and understand it in a really easy way.
I think it's also important in terms of assumptions that rural people are all conservative, reactionary, and there's wonderful rural organizing going on around this issue.
And the landowners, there are over 90 landowners who are publicly opposing this, who have not given permission, who have said they will fight this every step of the way, and they are personally... They have turned down very large offers of money to be able to use their land. So they are taking a stand saying, no, we know this is not right. And it's really coming at a cost to them, at an actual financial cost, and the cost of this energy, of, you know, being in conflict in your community sometimes. So the people in Southern Oregon who are fighting this are really dedicated to it. And we need to stand with them.
The 350 PDX has also been involved in bringing environmental racism, in making that central to the climate movement. And this is one example of how climate change affects minority and indigenous communities more profoundly. And if people are already vulnerable in some way through their health or poverty makes people more vulnerable to these effects. Can you say more about how your organization is addressing this, and perhaps using the recent ballot measure that was passed last fall, that 350 PDX was on the steering committee of the Portland Clean Energy Fund that passed last fall. Just in closing, how did that fund, and what are the hopes for that addressing the inequality and racial injustice, right?
That's a lot in closing.
But it was part of the campaign, right?
It absolutely was. And so I'll just really quickly say, part of what made the Portland Clean Energy Initiative so groundbreaking was that climate groups and other groups here in town really followed the lead of our communities of color in outlining what the problem was and what the solutions needed to be. And then we were able to come together around that. And I think, you know, with this fight in Southern Oregon, it's been very important to listen to people on the ground, whether that's tribal communities that understand the impacts on the animals and the land and the water, understand it better than anyone, listening to them to find solutions, and also listening to people who are economically impacted, the landowners and people, you know, for whom this is put forward as a short-term economic solution that would make life easier in the short term, but they're standing strong and saying, no, this is not the future for us.
So where do people gather? And just give us, in closing, a few details, and we'll post it. I assume there's more details on the 350 PDX.
Yeah, we'll have details on our website, which is 350pdx.org. It's this Thursday is the rally. It's a big rally at the state capitol.
November 21st?
November 21st, 11 to 1. We will have a bus to go down from 350 PDX. So if you want to come to our office at 9 a.m., you can get a ride on that bus. And our office is at Central Lutheran Church. Just look us up. It's in Northeast. I'll put the address online.
Okay, and we're red. But if you don't have anything red, you're still welcome to be there. We need to have our voices and our presence there to let the governor know how we feel about this.
That's right.
Thank you so much
for being
with us today, Anais Tipker with 350 PDX.
Thanks very much for having me.
And thank you, Jan and Anais. We're going to conclude today's show with a little tribute to Joe Hill. It's November 19th. Tomorrow marks the 104-year anniversary of the death of Joe Hill, songwriter and member of the Industrial Workers of the World. We'll honor him this morning with a Phil Oakes tribute recorded live in Montreal, 1966. And let's just start that right now.
Joe Hill come over from Sweden shore, looking for some work to do, and the Statue of Liberty waved him by. As Joe come a sailing through Joe Hill, as Joe come a sailing through. Oh, his clothes were coarse and his hopes were high, as he headed for the promised land. Took a few weeks on the out-of-work streets before he began to understand. Before he began to understand. Then Joe got hired by Bowery Bar, sweeping up the saloon, as his rag would sail o'er the barroom rail. Sounds like he whistled on a tune. You could almost hear him whistling on a tune. And Joe rolled on from job to job, from the docks to the railroad line. And no matter how hungry the hand that wrote, in his letters he was always doing fine. In his letters he was always doing fine. Oh, the years went by like the sun going down, slowly turned the page. And when Joe looked
back at the sweat upon his tracks. He had nothing to show but his age. He had nothing to show but his age. So he headed out for the California shore. There things were just as bad. So he joined the industrial workers of the world, 'cause the union was the only friend he had. 'Cause the union was the only friend he had. Now the strikes were bloody and the strikes were black, as hard as they were long. In the dark of the night, Joe would stay awake and write. In the morning, he would raise them with a song. In the morning, he would raise them with a song. And he wrote his words to the tunes of the day, to be passed along the union by. And the strikes were led and the songs were spread, and Joe Hill was always on the line. Yes, Joe Hill was always on the line. Now in Salt Lake City, hardly clue to find. Oh, the proof was poor, but the sheriff was sure that Joe was the killer of the crime. That Joe was the killer of the crime. Joe raised his hands, but they shot him down. He had nothing but guilt to give. It's a doctor I need, and they left him to bleed. But he made it, 'cause he had the will to live. Yes, he made it, 'cause he had the will to live. Then the trial was held in a building of wood, and there the killer would be named. And the days weighed more than the cold copper ore, 'cause he feared that he was being framed. 'Cause he found out that he was being framed. Oh, strange are the ways of the Western law. Strange are the ways of fate. For the government crawled to the mine owner's call, and the judge was appointed by the state. Yes, the judge was appointed by the state. Oh, Utah justice can be had, but not for a union man. And Joe was warned by some early morn, there'd be one less singer in the land. There'd be one less singer in the land. Now William Spry was Governor Spry, and life was his to hold. On the last appeal fell a governor's tear. May the Lord have mercy on your soul. May the Lord have mercy on your soul. Even President Wilson held up the day, but even he would fail. For nobody heard the soul-searching words of the soul in the Salt Lake City jail. Of the soul in the Salt Lake City jail. For 36 years he lived out his days, and he more than played his part. For the songs that he made, he was carefully paid, with a rifle bullet buried in his heart. With a rifle bullet buried in his heart. Yes, they lined Joe Hill up against the wall, blindfold over his eyes. It's the life of the rebel that he chose to live. It's the death of the rebel that he died. It's the death of the rebel that he died. In his time in the cell, he wrote to his friends,
his wishes all were plain. My body can't be found on the Utah ground, so they laid him on a fast parting train. Yes, they laid him on a fast parting train. And the rebel rode to Chicago town. There were 30,000 people to mourn. And just about the time that Jolie died, legend was just being born. A legend was just being born. Now some say Joe was guilty as charged, some say he wasn't even there. And I guess nobody will ever know, 'cause the court records all disappear. 'Cause the court records all disappear. Say wherever you go in this fair land, in every Union hall, in the dusty dark, these words are marked in between. It's the very last lines that Joe Hill wrote when he knew that his days were through. Boys, this is my last and final will. Good luck to all of you. Good luck to all of you.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. Coming up at 10, it's Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein, talking with Columbia Insights publisher Susan Hess and managing editor Dak Gollins. At 11, it's First Voices Radio, global topics and issues of critical importance to the preservation and protection of Mother Earth, with host Tjokason Ghosthorse. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO at kboo.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Then download our mobile app today. I want to thank our guests and our old moles, Bill Resnick, Dan Jaffe, Jan Hawken, and their guest, Dr. Gisela Rodriguez, Anna East Tupker, and Ron Jacobs. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.